Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
A Listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
Howdy, good people. Episode 209 of the Howie Games Part A features one of the greatest cricketers Australia has ever produced, Meg Lanning.
Oh, that's a good shot. This is some class batting from the Australian captain.
She is absolute class personified. That is one magnificent 100 for the Australian captain, Meg Lanning, in just 51.
She does it! Lanning, you legend. What a century.
If you look at Meg's stats, they're incredible, incredible. Up there with the best, if not the best, in the history of the women's game. If you look at the success of the Australian team, Meg captain, they won everything numerous times. Powerhouse, the term doesn't do this side justice. There was an aura of invincibility about Meg's team. Meg Lanning is a true star of Australian sport.
So you search and try to find, but you don't know where to go. So many thoughts flood through your mind. You're confused and want to know. Mystery, what is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
But as much as Meg gave of herself on the field, Meg is the first to say she hasn't been one to give much of herself off the field. That's Meg, and all power to her. Think about it, you're a sports fan. What do you know about Meg Lanning? Not much. I certainly didn't until now. In many ways, Meg, especially over the last few years, has been a mystery to cricket lovers. She has guarded her life and her story very closely. What she has been working through privately has been just that, private. But Meg, in this conversation, has decided to tell her story in detail, both as a cricketer and as a person. She has done it to help others who may be experiencing some of the challenges she's been confronting, so much so when the podcast finished, as you're about to hear, Meg was questioning whether she had explained herself enough, whether she'd gone into enough detail. Outstanding podcast. You okay?
Yeah, fine.
Good.
Was that all right? I feel like I could have gone, I gave you a bit, but I could have, I don't know.
Well, that's up to you.
Mm. Just as long as it sort of made sense still.
If you've got things that you still want to say that you think will help people, then you should talk more about it.
Mm.
If you want to keep some of your story to yourself, then you shouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
I think when people come on here and are vulnerable and talk openly about the issues they've had, that is when we get hundreds and hundreds of messages saying, I listened to Owen Wright talk about concussion and as a result it helped me do this. Or I listened to Liesl Jones talk about depression and it helped me do this. So, I don't know.
Well, let's go. Do you want to go again? Not again, but and you just ask questions and I'll answer.
Okay.
And then this bit I might need to listen to again.
Okay. You'll hear more of this. Meg isn't someone to share the details of her life. She's not that type of person. She knows, though, what she has spoken about here will make its way into the media due to her profile and that you and many others will now know intimate details about her life off the field. But she's chosen to do this, as I said, in the hope and realisation that through telling her own story, Meg can positively influence the community. I never know what the right terms are to use here. To tell your story like this, is it courageous? Is it selfless? Is it fearless? Probably all of the above. I'm not sure. What I am sure about, though, is that Meg, telling her story in depth, the triumphs and the challenges, adds even more layers to her brilliance on the field. it adds to her legend as a true great of Australian sport. Enjoy the untold story of Meg Lanning, a woman of tremendous character.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie. Come on, children, tread with me. We want to reach Mount Zion.
I reckon there are some things as a cricket fan when you walk past the telly, you simply have to watch. I would say Ricky Ponting's pull shot. I would say Mark Waugh's clip off his legs. And I would say Meg Lanning's cover drive. And she sits here across from me. Meg, welcome to the Howie Games. How are you?
Thanks, Howie. I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me on. I'm a big fan. I've listened to many episodes at home and abroad. So I'm looking forward to the chat.
Do you stick to the cricketers or do you go across all sports?
I like to venture out a little bit. Obviously know a little bit more about cricket, but I'm a keen sports fan. Any sport that's happening at the time, I like to get into, and listening to hear other athletes and people talk about their journeys is something I really enjoy doing.
Well, you immediately walked in here and started lamenting the fact the Swans had got beat by Richmond. I said, let's not talk about it too much. Let's save it for the podcast. So, and you were starting to run me through forward structures and what's happening in the bounce. So you obviously love your AFL.
I do. Dad's from Victoria, so. That's where sort of the love of AFL came from. Grew up in Sydney, actually, hence going for the Swannies. Mum and Dad were actually members of the Swans when they first moved to Sydney. They keep telling me that they were going along to games when there were about 100 people in the stands and not much happening. And then we were members all through sort of primary school when I lived in Sydney, and loved the Swannies.
Who was your player at that stage when you were in primary school?
Paul Kelly.
Paul Kelly.
Yeah, he was my... He was my favourite. He was the skipper. I remember the day he did his knee, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember who we were playing, but it was at the SCG and it was a bit of a disaster. Being a lifelong Swannies fan, try and keep up with them as much as possible. And whenever I am back in Melbourne and they come down to play, I try to go along and watch. But, I ride the highs and lows, and a little bit frustrating on the weekend, I must admit.
So tell me about what happened. You got beat by Richmond. What was Meg Lanning's analysis of the scenario out in the middle?
We just didn't look like it. Just looked a little bit off from the start. Mm-hmm. And we have tended to do that a little bit, actually, which is quite frustrating because we've got some good young kids. Errol Gordon's my favourite.
Mm.
So we can play some good footy, some exciting footy, and then I guess like most teams, you have your patches where not quite as good. But, I love watching them play every weekend.
You've been to 2 grand finals to see the Swans, and you are 0.
I'm not allowed to go anymore if we make another one.
So which did you go to? You went to the Geelong one, and that's not good.
You know what? I've actually been to 3 losing grand finals now I think about
right.
it.
Right.
The second West Coast one.
Okay.
Where we lost by a point.
Oh, that's got to hurt.
Yeah, that wasn't good.
How was that walking out of the G that day?
Yeah, not that was...
So you didn't go to the one they won?
No, I missed that one. I was away playing hockey, I think, interstate.
Right.
Watched it on TV, so that was okay. And then I thought I'd go along the next year and we'd get another win, and then we lost by a point. Then I was at the Hawthorn... was that 2014, I think?
It was a beautiful day for football.
It was all good until the first bounce, and then it went downhill from there. And the Geelong one a couple of years back was a similar story. So, yeah, I've been banned from going to any more down the track.
We're going to talk about cricket, but before we start at the start, you've just come back from the WPL, and we'll get to the crowds and stuff you played in front of when you started playing international cricket. But tell me about the WPL. So there's obviously the IPL in India and then the Women's Premier League. I watched parts of it and the crowds were enormous. It was mind-blowing. I haven't seen it. I've seen the IPL live. What's the experience like?
It's a lot of fun. There's always something happening. And the crowds and the atmosphere is something I don't think I've experienced before, or maybe once the World Cup final at the G. That's probably the only other time.
Yeah.
But over there, it's consistent. It's every game. They follow their sort of teams or players like crazy. So we played in Bangalore for the first half, and you couldn't hear yourself think. Running between the wickets is a challenge with playing in a new team with people who you're not. Yeah. Familiar with, so that's a challenge to start off with.
And different languages.
Different
too.
Languages. And then you also can't hear the person at the other end. So essentially it was just sort of watching each other, trying to make sure we didn't get run out. But, yeah, the crowds were just amazing. The atmosphere it created, you know, you sort of look around sometimes and wonder, you know, what you're doing and how you sort of came to be involved in something like that. And yes. It's been a bit of a game changer for the women's game, I think. It's sort of just shown how passionate they are for cricket over there and sort of what's possible sort of moving forward for the game.
I've been privileged enough to experience it at the IPL and going back to the hotel room and the cricketers arrive in the foyer and it is bedlam. What's it like when you girls come and go?
Well, when you win, it's bedlam.
Okay.
When you lose, nothing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So
you're arriving back after a win. Describe it when you get off the team bus.
So firstly, when you leave the hotel to go to the game,
yeah.
You've got all the hotel staff and everyone there with flags for your team sending you off to the game in style. And then if you've had a win, it's all fun and games. Everybody's up and about. It's celebration, like you've won the tournament, really. It actually takes a bit of getting used to because it's not really how we do it here.
No.
In Australia, you've got to keep a lid on it.
One game at a time. Over structures
there,
and processes.
Go with it. Just, you know, really embrace the fact that you're winning. And then you get back to the hotel and, again, there's all these staff, more staff than there were when they left. And there's music, there's a cake. There's always a cake.
A cake?
Yeah, yeah. When you get back and you've had a win. Congratulations, Delhi.
Do we eat cake or is it too much cake? Because you're on a successful team.
it depends on that.
Okay.
Like most people do. It's, you know, it'd be rude not to sort of try it out. So, yeah, the cake's there when you win and it's celebrations, drinks, everything going on. And then when you lose, it's like silence and then you get back, nothing. Nothing. So it's
no one looking anyone in the eye.
No, there's no one in the hotel. It's just it was quite eye opening to start with. It's sort of I feel like it sends the wrong message in a way, but that's how they roll over there.
Yep.
The highs and the lows, like there's a massive roller coaster, which is a little bit different to how sort of or any of the teams that I've operated in before. You try and keep it relatively level. But I think what I have learned going over there is the more you just embrace and go with the flow and don't ask too many questions around things. Like some things just don't make sense because they're just different. Mm. Obviously, the culture's very different. You just got to try and embrace it. And the more you do that, the more you enjoy it and the less worked up I think you can get about things. So that's sort of how I've tried to approach it.
After the Men's World Cup final, which I was very privileged to be at in Ahmedabad November. Meg, I couldn't get out because my flight was booked late. I couldn't get out for 3 days. And every morning at breakfast, like, as you know, they're the world's nicest people in India and they just love talking about cricket. And the blokes at the buffet and bringing the tea and stuff, like, because Australia won, they were that flat. They didn't want to look in your eye. They didn't want to serve you. And I was giving to them for 3 days. I was the last person, you know, I met about and they knew I was Australian. It's hard to explain to people the passion for the game in India. Do you get, because the cricketers rarely leave the hotel during the World Cup or the IPL due to the nature of the madness. Do you get to go outside of the hotel? And if you do, what type of recognition is there for you and your teammates?
I probably venture out a little bit more than most because I can't sit still.
Yeah, I'm the same. I have to be
so
out the door.
I like to be able to go out. It sort of depends where we are. Obviously, like, safety is important and that sort of drilled into us a little bit. But I do like to go out and see different things.
We need to go together because this is what I do. Like, the IPL, you do a game and then next morning you fly and then you have that afternoon off before the next game. So I just, no map, just walk for hours and the things you see.
Yeah, and I generally walk to find coffee.
Right.
Which in India is a bit more of a challenge than it is back here in Melbourne. But I have managed to find places wherever I've gone. So it sort of it's a bit of a novelty, I guess. Like I get to, so, you know, I think when I was in Bangalore, I was walking sort of 45, 50 minutes to find a coffee. Now it sounds a bit silly, but it gave me something to do and it actually allowed me to see the different parts of the cities that I was in. And I wouldn't really do that if I wasn't doing that. So I guess it's a bit different for us compared to the guys in terms of people sort of know and you sort of, you get a few looks here and there, and people the odd selfie and things like that, but nothing that would make me not sort of not be able to go out. So I guess that's lucky in a way. I can go out and all of us can sort of go out and do different things. But as the tournament goes on, that it happens more and more. People are recognizing you a little bit. And
well, because it is every news station, every TV station.
Yeah.
You're in the gym and there's nothing on the telly but cricket, cricket and cricket.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's good.
You watch
good.
Your own highlights, Meg, which is good.
I don't like to, but sometimes you're
sure
in the
you
gym.
Don't.
And it's all right if you've won the night before, you've played well or whatever, and they're watching the highlights. But if you've had if it's a bad game and you've lost, you know, I don't want to be watching.
But you see it a lot.
And it's just there. You can't escape it.
I spoke to Tim David about this, and he'd smacked a few, and I saw him, and I said, mate, all I've seen the last 3 days is you making your 62 not out. He said, yeah, that's great. But he said, when you make a duck, you can't escape it, me.
Yeah, yeah. Because we lost the final, and I had a few days in Delhi before I flew out. And I was just sitting down in the bar having a Diet Coke, I think, at the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know, the strong stuff. And and then the final came on a replay, and I was like, oh, that's my cue to leave. Because it was just, you just can't escape it. It's everywhere. But it just, that's just what they love. And that's, it's pretty much their life. And, the amount of people who care about the game and sort of what happens is pretty incredible. It's an absolutely incredible country.
Have you had the pleasure of going to Mumbai or not?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Mumbai, yeah.
I don't know whether you've been to the Maidan, the cricket ground. Like the thing that struck me anywhere in India, but especially, like, I played a lot of cricket. I played a lot of cricket on the street all over the place, Megan. I'm sure you don't get that opportunity, but just grounds, just chockers with boys, girls, kids, adults playing cricket, and, you know, you point in one game, but you square leg in another game, and there's balls flying around.
Yeah,
as a cricket fan, which you and I ostensibly are, when it's all said and done, you're very good at the game, and I talk about the game, but I think that's the thing I love about it. It's just cricket everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's sort of organised in some ways, but unstructured in a lot
very
as well. It's just like
I would say.
You just turn up and you play, and it's sort of, it doesn't matter who's playing. It's just, you know, there's a game going on somewhere, and the IPL, the WPL last year was based just in Mumbai.
Okay.
So,
where'd you stay?
The Taj.
So, so now we need to explain to people, well, I've been there. Nice hotel, but this is your two-star backpacker where Meg is. So this is overlooking the most historic parts of Mumbai. Wow.
Yeah, beautiful spot. So that was good because it allowed me to get out a little bit in that sort of area. And there's that, I don't know if it's the same place you were talking about, that ground where there's a nice track that goes around the outside of it. And there's just like literally like many games going on every day.
Got to be 40 games at any stage.
Yeah, incredible. And all different ages, kids, boys, girls, adults, like it's and all times of the day too. It's incredible. I walked past them numerous times and would just sort of watch and see sort of how it was all going down. But everywhere you look in India, there's a game of cricket going on. You can see the passion and how much they love the game, and it's pretty cool to see. Obviously, here in Australia, it's all so structured and much more organised. But they just love it and they just go and play. It's pretty cool to see.
Do you ever get in that situation when you're playing, say, in the WPL, and look around and think, when I started playing professional cricket as a teenager, there'd be, you know, three men and a dog there.
Mum and dad.
Yeah, and mum and dad and the parents. And now you're playing in front of tens of thousands of people that know your name. There's enormous television rights now at stake. You're obviously getting paid. I should have looked. I don't know. You got paid. How much do you get paid to play in the WPL, Meg? Like it's an auction stitch.
Yeah,
so
it is.
All out
I think it was a 180K or something like that. I mean, the whole auction thing was a crazy thing.
Well, okay, we'll stop that point then. Tell me about the auction then.
Yeah. So it was obviously new.
So, but before we go,
Meg's
played in the last 2 years. You were the leading run scorer in the first year. Your team lost the final. You're the second leading run scorer this time, just behind Elise Perry. And again, unfortunately, your team lost the final. Next year, you'll be the leading run scorer and you'll win it. So that Meg has dominated the competition. So have you been through one auction or two auctions?
Just one auction.
Okay, so tell us about it.
Well, it happened at a really interesting time, actually, for the women's game. It was smack bang in the middle of the T20 World Cup last year.
Yep.
So you got this new concept of an auction. Obviously, everyone wants to be part of it, and it was right in the middle of the World Cup, so that just sort of added another element to it for us as a team and individually. We had a few conversations on how we were going to manage it, because obviously everyone wanted to be a part of it, but you don't really have any control over how it pans
control.
Out. I didn't watch it personally. I sent a message to a friend and I was like, can you watch it for me and just send me a text what happens? Because I just couldn't bring myself to watch it.
So for those that haven't followed it, you have, is there financial bans that you put yourself in?
I think you put a reserve price in.
Right.
Yeah. But they're all relatively low for us initially, and nobody knew sort of what they were walking into. So you put your reserve price in and then you sort of just got to let it play out.
And you didn't watch it?
No, I didn't watch it.
Jeez, your eyes cold.
I couldn't watch it. I just found the whole thing so strange. Just being auctioned off.
Right.
Everybody knowing what you go for, all that sort of thing. I just found it really strange. So I was like, I just want to be part of it. So hopefully I get picked up I'll just go with it from there. We actually had a training session at the time of the auction. I think it was optional. It was early in the tour, so everybody was there. That's what happens. later in the tour, there's nobody at optional trainings.
Well, the blokes don't turn up to optional trainings at all from what I can gather, so yeah. I'm glad some are there at the start of
So some of the girls were watching it on their phones and all
at
sorts
training.
Of... Yeah. Like,
wow.
They obviously were finished
yes, of
their
course.
Hit and they were just on the side. But I don't know. I just found it weird, so I couldn't watch it. But it luckily for us, it was on a rest day, so then we dealt with it and moved on. But I know some of the England girls were on their way to play their game, and they were having their team meeting. They were staying at the same hotel as the Indian girls.
Yep.
So the England girls could hear all the Indian girls cheering, people getting auctioned off and bought by teams. And then some of the England girls, and same as the Australian girls, some got picked up, some didn't. And it was just like this like whole crazy rollercoaster of emotions for people, different for everybody. Some people went for crazy money, some people who you're like, oh, they're an amazing player, went for not much. Like that's sort of the luck of the draw.
Was it Ash Gardner?
Yeah.
Went for about
500 and something? Yeah. So like for us, like that's just like next level. So it was a very interesting experience, the whole auction thing.
So your first game for Australia, cast your mind back. The first time you represented Australia, which would have been as a 17-year-old?
Yeah, maybe I was 18.
Okay. So can you cast your mind back to what you would have got paid for your first game to play for Australia?
Oh, I don't think we got much payments back then.
Okay.
I think the contracting system was three tiers, 5,000, 10,000 and 15,000.
For the year?
Yeah, that were the contracts.
Which tier did you jump into?
I started at 5.
Okay.
Yeah.
So hence the question I was trying to ask you before. You've gone in this auction and sold for nearly $200,000. That... You need to keep hanging on, Meg, because that's going to get up to 4 and 5. But like the Phoebe Litchfields of the world will be $1 million. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
So it's an extraordinary journey in one person's career from 5,000 for a year to 200,000, or in Ash's case, $500,000 for a month, isn't it? It really is. And it's credit to all the hard work that you've done and those before you, the Mel Joneses, the Lisa Stelakers, the Belinda Clarks.
Mm.
Have done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy to think where the game's at now. And I've said this to a few of the girls. It's like, I can't get my head around what it's going to look like in 10 years' time. Hopefully it's better again, in a better place in terms of I hope so. In terms of how much cricket people are playing, the conditions, the pay, all of that. I hope it continues to get better for the young players coming through. That's really important because and we've spoken a lot about this as Australian team is making sure that we have respect and understand the work that came before us from, a lot of the past Australian players who didn't get paid at all to play for Australia. In fact, some of them paid to play.
Absolutely.
Which is hard to get your head around, playing now, but that's why, yeah, hopefully in 10 years' time it continues to improve and become bigger and better and there's more opportunities for young girls. That's really, really crucial for us. So to have been through that sort of, yeah, journey of very much part-time training after hours, touring once or twice a year, no crowds, to playing in the WPL and being paid to play and playing all year round. It's been a pretty incredible journey to sort of see. And I think, like, I feel quite lucky to actually to have been part of the sort of the transition
well,
into
had
that
both,
bit.
Haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. So
you've seen the non-professional yeah. to what is now fully professional.
Yeah. And I think that non-professional or sort of part-time era taught me a lot. And I learnt a lot through that period of time, which sort of has helped me towards the back end a little bit. Now young players coming in don't necessarily have to work or study or sort of time manage as much in terms of with life and things like that. So that's a different challenge for them to navigate. And that doesn't mean it's easier or harder, but it's just different. But I feel like the fact that I started when I did and now it's gotten to that point, it sort of taught me a fair bit throughout, which I think I'm very thankful for.
With the money and the exposure comes increased pressure, though, like in any job. And I, 200 odd episodes of this show, there's a few things that stick in my mind. And one was what Elise said when she came on the show, I don't know, 5 years ago. And she felt for the development of the game, she wanted to read in the paper, Perry was out for a duck to a shot she'd be disappointed by. She slashed wide outside off stump and it was a poor dismissal, for want of a better term. I read the sports pages religiously. Mm. I'm not sure we're there yet. How do you sit on Indians are a lot more direct with feedback, I find, in the media.
Yeah.
But yeah. Have you ever read about yourself basically – Lanning stuffed it. So,
yeah.
You know, you saw what's going with Alex Carey or Manus Labuschagne at the moment, or yeah. if Starkey has a bad spell, bang, straight into it. Where do you sit on that? I don't know. I don't really understand that situation.
No, there's probably been two times in my career where I felt like that happened. That was the 2017 World Cup when we lost in the semi-final to India.
And the final wicket has fallen. And India are through to the finals. The second time they'll be in a World Cup final at Lord's.
Which is the first time in a while we'd sort of not done as well as maybe what we should have.
Let's be honest, not won the tournament.
Yep, which was our expectations and other people's expectations too. And then the T20 World Cup here in Australia, where we actually... It ended well, but the wheels were falling off a little bit at the start of the tournament. So those couple of times. Probably,
was that discussing your batting performance or your captaincy?
More around the team,
okay.
I would say.
The team.
I feel like we've gotten to the point where maybe questions can be asked or asked of the team if it's not quite going well, but whether individually we're there yet, maybe not.
And do you think it should be or shouldn't be?
Oh, I personally get a little bit frustrated having seeing the negativity towards some sports people.
I agree,
I think
100%.
Of Finchie when he
yep.
sort of the back end of his career, how much people were talking about. You know, how it was going, you know, it's time to finish up, pretty much calling quits for his career for someone who'd done so incredibly well throughout for a long period of time. It just turns really quickly and then they retire and it's like, oh, what an amazing player. We're going to miss him. Holds. David Warner was sort of a similar
thing. We do retire our champions here, don't
yeah.
we? Whereas the Americans, please keep playing. Please yeah. keep playing. Play one more season. Give us another year's entertainment.
Yeah. I actually went on a holiday to America in November 2022. I can't remember, a couple of years ago. And I went to a couple of sports and I loved it. And one of the bits that I did love was how the players, it sort of looked like they could just be themselves and really express themselves. And I in my head, I was thinking if that was happening in Australia, that would be called arrogant. whether it's their celebrations or how they talk after the game. Like,
if they are on the same page here, Meg. I honestly,
yeah,
I could not agree with you more.
Yeah, it's like if they'd had a good game, they said they had a good game.
I'm the man. I'm the woman.
Yeah.
Whereas here, we want them to say,
so, "Oh, no, no, that like, yeah, I just did it for the team." Like,
could have done it. And without
don't get wrong,
girls.
I probably have done
a
long period of time. But that's it's drilled into us to actually. Yeah. Respond like that. And I loved that part of the American sports is that you could just see people being themselves and being out there and carrying on, like carrying on with their celebrations and whatnot. But it was like, I actually really loved that aspect of it because that doesn't happen here in Australia.
So if you peeled off 100 off 48 deliveries and I came to interview you, is there any part of you would, Meg, you, that was unbelievable. You know what, Howie? I was on fire today. Is there any part of you that wants to express yourself like that? Because it's so against what we, I don't know why, that's against what we do here.
Yeah, I think I'd be mindful, yeah, and I wish I didn't feel like that, but that's sort of, yeah, how it's come up. So I think, yeah, I think we can just be overly negative about things. And like, yeah, even David Warner, like the way sort of it finished up with him here and now he's gone and it's like, oh, we're missing David Warner, like, you know. And it's like if you go back and read all the stuff that everybody was writing before he retired or made the decision, it's just like, I don't know, it sort of just grinds my gears a little bit sometimes because I just feel like they're greats of the game who have significantly contributed over a long period of time and we just sort of turn on them pretty quick. But then we celebrate them when they finish up and it's like, oh, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me sometimes.
I'm in complete agreement. Okay, cricket, when do you first start playing cricket? Where are you? How old are you?
Oh, primary school. Warrawee Public School.
Right.
And it would have been recess and lunch. Always with the boys, none of the girls were playing, but didn't really bother me too much. I was happy just playing and then I remember one of the teachers came up, was in grade 5, and he sort of mentioned that there was a rep girls team trials that were coming up and sort of asked if I wanted to get involved, and I did. Went along and then, sort of made that team and then sort of just went from there. There's 5 kids in our family, so my younger sister Anna also played a lot of cricket. So we had a lot of battles in the backyard as well, so that's sort of my first memories.
Would that rep team be in the first or girls team you played in? Were you playing with the boys as you're growing up?
Yeah, well, I was just playing it with the boys at school.
Yep.
And then,
so what would be your first organised cricket? The rep team? Or
a couple of school games.
Okay.
Yeah, but then the rep team.
Were you the only girl in the school team?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But it never occurred to me that was an issue.
Yeah, grade 5, grade 6.
Yeah, yeah, I just wanted to play. It didn't really bother me. I did the same with sort of soccer and AFL and all that. Yeah, so then Sydney North was the team that I first played for. They were my sort of regional team that we played a tournament in when I was, grade 5, I think.
And were you, I always ask this question, and I always use this same analogy. Were you Ricky Ponting, always unbelievable and way better than everyone else, or were you, and was always going to play for Australia, or were you Justin Langer that was talented but had to work extremely hard? So now you can put your American hat on and be honest, Meg.
I think if I'm honest, yep. I probably, looking back, always did quite well straight away and probably made all of the teams that I tried out for and sort of kept progressing pretty quick. So I didn't probably realise it at the time, but looking back, having had a little bit of time to reflect recently, I probably was one of the better players right from sort of the start, and things seemed to flow relatively, the path seemed to flow relatively, not easily is not the right word, but sort of in a linear sort of fashion.
So if I have a child now that is a girl, which I do, who's not into cricket, she had a good in-swinger too at 12.
It's a good skill to have.
I know, I don't know. Anyway, it's a story for another day. But she would be growing up, and the local club I play for now has got girls' teams, women's teams, and they look up to you and Alyssa and Elise and Ash. But when you grew up, were the girls that you looked up to, or I know that you were a big Ricky fan?
No, there wasn't, because I didn't know that women's teams really existed, exactly, to be honest. I just I didn't know girls' teams existed until the teacher came up and asked if I wanted to try out. So that was the first sort of time I realised or knew that there was women's cricket. But it was only men's cricket on TV. So, you know, whatever you see and watch is sort of all you really know. So
can't see it, you can't be it.
Yeah. It's a really true saying that. I don't think I realised what it meant for a while, but it's, you know, looking back at my sort of pathway through, Ricky Ponting was my hero and someone I love watching.
When did you first meet him?
Oh, I met him very briefly when I was in high school.
Were you a fangirl?
A little bit. It was at a sports management company thing. There were a few young athletes there and Ricky came along and he just did a quick chat and a few questions and stuff like that. So I probably didn't ask any questions because I would have been shy, but that was the first time I met him. I've met him a couple of times otherwise, but I can't say we know each other well, but even just listening to him commentate these days.
It's very good, isn't
he? Yeah, he is. Yeah, you can just tell he just knows what he's talking about.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because obviously you're at Delhi now in the WPL, yeah. And he's the Delhi,
yeah,
the man in charge there. There's, I guess, the first time the public was gained an understanding of who, yeah, Meg Lanning was. And I was actually reading the article. I found the article when you made a splash as a young schoolgirl at Carey. I'm sure you've spoke about this before. I didn't realise because my young fella is now playing cricket for Geelong College. So in that scene,
APS,
he plays in year seven, and I've been to watch him this year, and they played Carey, and I was like, Meg's team. So for those that aren't aware, put your American hat on and tell people how you hit the headlines, Meg.
Yep. Okay. So I was the first girl to be part of a team in the APS competition, which is the comp where there's Melbourne Grammar, Scotch College, the Geelong teams, Carey, Caulfield, and all sorts of other schools.
And so, amazing facilities.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I definitely took for granted. Like, right, you don't realise how good they are. Like, immaculate.
Crazy.
Outfields, pitch is beautiful. Like,
well, young Mako does, my son, because he's come from Barwon Heads Primary.
Yeah, yeah.
And playing on hard wickets.
Yeah.
And he goes to, without sidetracking you, his sister went there and he's like, oh, Dad, I don't know if I want to go here. I said, well, let's just go for a look around. And we picked Sky up and there was three turf wickets. And he said, Dad, I'm ready to go. But yeah, amazing facilities.
Yes, yeah. So like I started playing in the boys' team. So we moved from Sydney to Melbourne, start of high school for me.
Yep.
So went to Carey and initially they were like, well, we've only got boys teams, so you can give it a crack, have a go. If you like it, great, keep going. If you don't like it, we'll pick another sport. So you have to play a summer and a winter sport.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay, like I wasn't thinking too much of it. So I played sort of the 7As, 8As, 9As on turf, by the way. In year seven and year eight, like incredible wickets. Like, yeah, I didn't realise at the time, but it was pretty cool. I even went on a trip to England, a cricket trip to England with the school team. Again, the only girl.
Only girl?
Yep. Didn't really think too much of it. Like, I'd been part of the teams for a little while.
Did you make runs in England?
Oh, I think I made 150.
Okay.
Not many.
Righto. How were you going in 7, 8, and 9?
Okay. To be honest, actually, I was actually more of a bowler.
Oh.
Yeah, I actually made my first state team in under 12s as a bowler.
What, were we sending down heat or?
Well, at that time it was not heat, but like pretty good control, good outswing. And then the older I got, the quicker I got and the less control I got.
Right.
The radar went off. If you ask anyone who's faced me bowl or seen me bowl, they don't know where it's going. I don't know where it's going. But it was quick.
This I didn't know about
yet. Yeah. Yeah, so I've got international wickets.
Right.
I do like to talk about them,
okay,
actually.
How many international wickets?
I think I'd say at least 5.
Who's your best?
Amy Satterthwaite, got her twice.
How?
LBW and, I don't know, maybe Court.
I like that you know that.
Yeah, yeah. So I was mainly bowling, to be honest. It actually worked in my favour a lot of the time because the boys were scared to get out to the girl. So they were just like, you know, pulling around, trying not to get out.
That's so true. That is so true.
Because they would just get stick from their mates.
Yeah.
And not just at the game, like during the week and stuff like that. I tried to use that to my advantage. So that helped. So I made a few runs here and there, but not that well. So then I played all through year 7, 8, 9. And then the APS comp works, so it starts actually in term 4. You play some two-day cricket.
Yep.
So I actually played in the first 11 at the end of year 9.
At age 14.
Yeah, something like that.
It wasn't, it was actually, you were 14.
Yeah.
You were 14.
And so, yeah, I mean, to be fair, I probably still don't quite realise it now. And I definitely didn't realise it.
Did the school make a big deal of it?
Not really. I mean, I've always been someone who likes to just sort of cruise along and not really make too much of a deal of anything. And the only reason I sort of thought something was up a little bit is because a couple of radio stations rang mum and dad. I don't know how they get their number. Like, that's just a bit
rang
strange.
The old landline?
Yeah, yeah. Well, not on the mobile. Okay. Maybe landline, no. And they wanted to do a few interviews.
And did you?
Oh, probably. God, I'd hate to listen to them.
Oh, I'd love to find that.
I'd hate to listen to them. And they wanted to chat about it. And, like, that was the only reason it was sort of a bit. And then it sort of became a bit of a thing. But I never realised what sort of it was that I was doing, because I just wanted to play. And I'd played with them from year 7, 8, 9. Like, it just didn't seem like a really big deal to me. And even, like, today it sort of doesn't, but I'm probably understanding that it was a big deal. Yeah.
Yep.
I, like, look back at that time and, like, I loved it. It was challenging. Like, it took me out of my comfort zone a bit.
Yeah.
And there were times when the boys are a bit silly and you sort of just roll with it a little bit, but that's fine. But it actually, I look back, like, not only just from a cricket perspective, because we played some two-day stuff, which I think was really good. Sort of learned the game at quite a young age. But, yeah, just out of my comfort zone a little bit. And so I think it was a really good sort of lesson for me early on to sort of build some good mental toughness, I guess, and also test my skills. So I look back at that time and thoroughly enjoyed it and think it was a really important part of my sort of early pathway.
Back to Meg shortly. Next week on the show, an Anzac Day special. Whenever anyone asks me which episode should I listen to of your podcast, always the first recommended is Jack Jones. Jack was a World War II veteran, a three-time VFL Premiership player with his beloved Bombers, and simply the greatest Australian I've ever had the privilege of meeting.
And then it dropped in amongst us, you know. We had a lot killed in a lot of those raids.
That's not a job then, though.
Well, it sure was, because You didn't even think about it. You got up every morning, you didn't know whether you're going to be still alive by the end of the day. What could you do? I know people can't understand that.
I have no understanding.
You couldn't
what
be
you're
frightened
saying.
Because you had to look after you. I had to look after you, for instance, and I had to look after that bloke there, you know.
So you didn't feel fear?
No, never felt fear at all.
The great Jack Jones is sadly no longer with us, but I am lucky to work with his granddaughter, Sarah Jones, on Fox Footy. She is a star. And next week, Sarah shares family stories about her beloved Pop as we celebrate Jack and honour our veterans.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Alrighty, let's get back to Meg.
As you see, I have notes, but I rarely refer to them, but I want to get the dates right. So the 30th of December 2010, a T20 international versus New Zealand. You made your debut. You made 10 versus the Kiwis. Was playing for Australia everything it cracked up to be? What are your memories?
Well, that was my first T20. I was supposed to play a T20 a couple of days before, but we got washed out. So I had to wait a few more.
I see you selected, but no game.
Yeah, cool. No game. We sat in the change rooms in New Zealand for a couple of hours. And then, so this is my first tour. I didn't really expect to to play too much, to be honest. And I'd done a little bit at state level. I had a few like breakthrough innings probably, but not dominating for years to, sort of to get into the team. So I got picked quite early and didn't really think I'd play that much on the tour. But then I was opening the batting straight up, straight into it. I think that innings where I got 10, I think I hit a 6 and a 4.
Oh, you got on with it
then. And then I was out. I can't actually remember exactly where it was. It was a very small New Zealand town.
Big ground though, big boundaries.
Massive boundaries, yeah, massive. I don't remember a lot about it. I remember a little bit more about the series so directly after that, which was the Ashes. So we played New Zealand and flew directly over to Perth to start the Ashes series. So it was sort of a double tour.
So 7th of January 2011, you played your second one day international and you made 104.
Mm.
Versus England in Perth at 18 years, 288 days, the youngest ever Australian to make a century, passing the record of...
I want to say Ricky P.
Ricky P. Ricky, so we will talk about how phenomenal your international career has been. Well, I'll talk about it. You won't want to. But, you know, that's a big statement. That's a big statement. So, so in innings like that, does the world around you begin to change or not so much?
Not so much. Oh, I didn't think. I remember that game. Again, I think I was opening the batting in the one day as well, which was a bit new to me. I'd done it a little bit, but I'd always been sort of a 3, 4, or 5 batter.
I watched the innings. I watched it last night, but yeah. It's got a music montage. There's no commentary on it.
No.
You got a VHS somewhere tacked away or not?
Probably not. I don't know. Okay. I don't tend to have my highlights stored away, but
sure you don't.
Yeah, I remember that. And one of my favourite memories actually of, I think it was that game, is of the current Aussie coach, Shelley Nitschke.
Yes.
So we were opening the batting together. And there was an English keeper and she was giving me a bit of chirp.
Was she?
Yeah, which was fine. Nothing too untoward. But
what
just,
type of stuff was she giving you, Meg?
Just knew that I was young and... Okay. You know, and I was just a bit like, oh, whatever. And I just remember Shelley Nitschke marching down, as she does, and telling the keeper in no uncertain terms to shut up. She didn't use those words.
No.
And I was just in the middle of this, sort of not really knowing what to do. So that was my first sort of real, having Shell as my batting partner and sort of getting to know her a little bit. But I just remember her walking down and just like telling the keeper where to go, which I look back now and is quite funny. Obviously then she became the Aussie coach and assistant coach as well. So I remember that. And then, the innings, it just sort of happened. I don't know. I think I made 20-odd in the first ODI and thought, oh, yeah, like that was okay. Like it wasn't anything I didn't feel like I could do. And then... It all seemed to it fell into place a little bit in the second ODI, which was nice.
So, I had one of my sporting heroes, Kelly Slater, came on the show, Meg, and he's won 11 world titles. So, if you get, Mick Fanning on, you can probably talk about the 3 world titles with him. Kelly Slater, you can't go through and talk about every, and it's a bit the same with you. 250 over World Cups, 5 T20 World Cups. The most centuries of any female to ever play the game at international level. I want to ask you about some of those World Cups, but from your perspective, what made, like I mentioned your cover drive at the start, a very easy on the eye, very elegant batter. What was your key to success with bat in hand to the fact that you've broken every record in the women's game?
I think it's probably the mental side of my game, which I didn't really understand when I was initially playing, and sort of towards the back end, I probably understood a little bit more about it. But cricket's such a unique game that just because you have really, really good skills doesn't mean you're going to be successful, especially as a batter. Like
one chance.
Yep. Sometimes I wonder why the heck I became a batter. Like it's stupid. You could make half a mistake, a quarter of a mistake. Sometimes you don't even really make a mistake, and you're out. That's it. There's no coming back.
And like you watch all your mates bat for the rest of the day.
It's just like, that just makes no sense. Like, why would you voluntarily put yourself through that? Like,
it's a brutal, brutal game as a batter.
Yeah, it is. And it's not until you think about it like that, where it's like, geez, like making runs actually is not that easy. Like, it's hard. Like, even if you're facing people who you think are not that good at bowlers, like, it's not as simple as that. So I think I just had the ability to be able to make the right decisions out in the middle, when whether there was heaps of pressure or no pressure or different situations of the game. I don't know whether I naturally had that or I learned it. It's probably a bit of both.
So I was going to say, was it learned or innate?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of both, but I did have it from a young age, I guess, the ability to play well in a game. I just think cricket's so unique in that way, and that's what separates the good players from the great players, is their ability to execute when they need to over and over again. Like, and batting is just a classic. It's like you go out there for your first 10 balls and you're really switched on, because it's like, you know, you're most vulnerable in your first 10 balls. I get more nervous before the game and waiting, and then once I go out there, I'm fine.
Yep.
And you realise that it's just cricket. It's the same cricket you've been playing no matter what. But then you're like, and the moment you still start to feel comfortable, for me, that was always the danger time, because you're just like a little bit off, and it just, the moment you're just a little bit off, think you've got it all worked out, it all comes crashing down really quick. I think my ability to just stay switched on and make the right decisions at the right time, I think, is what has allowed me to be successful.
And then as a leader, you weren't very old when you took over captaining the country. What do you think the key, so 19th of January 2014, the youngest ever skipper of Australia, before you were made the full-time skipper, and then full-time skipper in Feb 2014, what do you reckon the key to the art of captaincy? It's such a disgusting in cricket, isn't it? Like, you're footy captain, soccer captain, you know, you toss the coin out, you go. But cricket, you are controlling
the game. You're running the show.
Yep.
Definitely on the field, but off the field pretty much as well, which I think is, again, very unique. I'd had no leadership experience whatsoever previously in any age group.
Had you captained any team?
I think I'd captained the hockey team at Kerry.
Before you captained Australia, you'd captained the Kerry hockey team.
Yeah, that was it. That was doing the speech after the game. Right. Speech after the game that we had to do. So I'd never even thought about it. It was not on my radar or something that I wanted to do. I hadn't really given it two thoughts.
How did you get told?
So initially what happened was the head of selectors wanted to catch up for a coffee. I was still really young. I had no idea what I was walking into. I was like, oh, maybe this is what they do. And she was like, oh, we want to make you vice captain. And I was like, oh, okay, like, yep. This is what I usually do. I'll just go with the flow. I'm like, oh, okay, yep, cool. And she was like, you'll sort of be under Jodie Fields, who was the captain. She'd been out for a little bit with a couple of serious hamstring injuries. So Alex Blackwell had actually been stepping in for her, and then she was vice captain. But I sort of went up into the vice captain sort of spot, which, it took me by surprise and probably a few by surprise. And then, so I was like, fine, I was going to learn under Jodie. And then we had an Ashes series coming up. So that was the first series where I was vice captain. And I distinctly remember Catherine Fitzpatrick saying to me, now, we do know that if Jodie gets injured, then this means that you will become captain. And we've thought about this and it's okay. And I'm like, okay. Didn't sound overly convincing, but I was like, yeah, cool. Like, you know, it's not going to happen.
Yep.
And still, like, I'd only been in the Aussie team for a couple of years, so I still felt like I was still finding my way a fair bit. Anyway, and then we played the test match in the Ashes series. We lost that. And then we came to Melbourne and it was a training session the day before the first ODI. and I was in the drill and someone threw a ball. Jodie Fields was going to catch it. It hit us, the stump just in front of her fingers and hit her on the end of the finger. And she walked off. And like, you get hit on your fingers a lot in cricket. So yes. It's not always a disaster if that happens. And yeah, anyway, and then that night, literally, Fitzy was like, Jodie's like out for the rest of the series. Like, you're it. I was just like, okay, right.
I can't believe you'd never have captained a cricket team to that point.
No, so I didn't know what I was doing. I had some good support. So Alex Blackwell was still in the side, so she was there. So I had some good support from the senior players. But I was genuinely making it up as I went along.
Were the senior players, were they fully on board or were they like, why is this young?
Oh, they were on board. It was a bit of a left field sort of decision, I think.
Why'd they do it then? What did they see in you?
Well, obviously they did see some leadership ability in me. I don't know if it was more the on-field stuff or the off-field team stuff. I'm not really sure. I was sort of just minding my own business being a batter.
Was it because that they knew that the world could see you were going to be the best batter in the team?
Yeah, maybe, but like that, I suppose that could have been the thinking back then. I think it's very different now.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, I didn't really know. And to be fair, I never really asked. I just sort of this is sort of my attitude to most things is sort of I get on with it and I make it work and you go with the flow and you know, you just find a way.
So was your head spinning when you led the team out?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. So I went out to the coin toss with Charlotte Edwards, who's like the greatest English player ever. And did the coin toss or whatever. So I was, and it was fine. Like, I think we lost the first couple of games and then we might have won a couple of games towards the back end of the series. But I had no idea what I was doing and I didn't have any idea what the role entailed or anything like that. And it grew and grew and grew over the time that I was in it. So that was part-time. And then the next tour that we had was a World Cup, T20 World Cup, Bangladesh. And Jodie was due to come back, but they decided that they wanted me to do it full time. So, yeah, it was a bit of a tricky period.
So there was some friction there?
A little bit, yeah, because just naturally because of making that decision. So then from then on I was in charge.
That T20 World Cup in Bangladesh, Australia versus England, you beat England again. England made 8 for 105. Australia get done 15 overs. Meg is top score 44 from 30.
Oh, that's a good shot. This is some class batting from the Australian captain. 37 for 1.
Pulled away. Such ferocity and timing from Lanning.
Hit down the ground, hit for 4. They're nearly there, Australia.
So your first full tournament, I didn't realise, a skipper, you've won the World Cup.
Mm.
A pretty good start.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yep.
Pulls it away and that's it. It goes for the boundary. Australia begin their celebrations. It's 3 on the bounce for Australia. They've won the last 3 World T20s. In this form of the game, they are by far the best side in the world.
Yeah, we definitely had the best team. And the on-field stuff, I feel like I took to really quickly. And maybe I understood the game a lot better than what I realised, and maybe other people saw that. The on-field stuff, the tactics, I feel like I picked up pretty quick. And obviously we had some good success on the field as well. So that was a
nice
start.
What about the off-field, being the face of the team, being every media conference? Because my dealings with you, reasonably reserved, as you said, you'd just sort of sit in the corner, make your runs and get it done. How is it being thrust into those press conference environments?
That was probably the harder part. Yep. Just getting used to that, all the extra commitments and obligations that you are required to do. And World Cups are sort of next level as well. There's the ICC sort of come into it and there's all these obligations you need to fulfill. That part I got used to. It was a bit annoying sometimes having to do everything, but that's okay. The hardest part I found is like the team stuff, in terms of building relationships in cricket, and I don't know if it's the same in other sports, but as soon as you have the captaincy, a barrier's all automatically put up.
What type of barrier?
Just in terms of how open and honest and the relationships you can build with people.
That sucks.
I haven't quite worked out exactly the full reason. I think it's definitely got a little bit to do with selection, because in cricket, one of the teams I was in, you're a selector. Yeah. So as soon as someone in the team knows that.
So you are a selector as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like naturally, you're probably going to want to just show your best to the captain, if that makes sense.
Well, you're not coming to your good mate Meg and saying, listen, I'm really struggling mentally with my game at the moment, are you?
No. So.
In case you don't pick them in the team.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that that happens in cricket. So naturally there's that barrier, which I never understood. I didn't realize, and a lot of these things you don't really realize until you're actually in the job. But yeah, just trying to look after everybody, make sure the environment's good, build the relationships, try and get the team on the same page, but you still want people to feel comfortable to be themselves and bring their unique strengths. Like that sort of stuff is the hardest part. It's the bit that you get the most out of, and in the teams that. Have been really successful that I've been in, like that's the best part, but it's that's the bit I found hardest, I guess. And I think even, you know, all the way till when I finished, I was always learning a lot about how to do that and how people operate, and people don't always think the same as me and all that, it was a really big learning curve for me to understand and empathize with other people as well. I would say initially my empathy levels, that wasn't one of my strengths.
Yeah.
But that's just because how I operate as a person, and I sort of couldn't quite understand that other people necessarily didn't see it how I saw it or feel the way I did. So that was something I had to work on a fair bit, to build those relationships and connections to everyone within the squad. You know, players and staff. That was a constant sort of area of work for me. But I think I got better at it. And that you know, now that I've sort of finished up, it is those relationships and connections that I constantly think about. And really the bit that I miss, as opposed to the cricket skills sort of thing. So that was the most challenging part of leadership for me, is working through that sort of personable and relationship side of things.
But you went on, was it 25, 26 matches in a row, the one day international team won. Like, you've captained the most successful cricket team in the history of Australian cricket. So you must have been on something, right?
That's
a phenomenal run.
Yeah, I think so. And
all the things that can go wrong in a game of cricket, you lose a couple of early wickets and to win that many matches in a row. Is it truly extraordinary, Meg?
Yeah. And I remember Matthew Mott, who was coach for a big chunk of my time with Australia and who had a massive influence on me as a person and a cricketer. He would always say, like, the best teams don't always win, especially in T20 cricket and World Cups, where it's, you know, it's a one-off sort of thing. But the fact we were able to win that many games over a long period of time.
Mm.
Is probably something that's quite an amazing achievement. And it came off the back of that disappointing sort of 2017 World Cup, where we sort of, like I said before, thought we had everything under control and didn't really need to do too much, and all came crashing down pretty quick. So that sort of spurred us on to that streak.
The T20 World Cup in Australia that everyone famously remembers, the win. I don't think a lot of people remember the semi-final, when things could have gone totally wrong. there was rain. I look back at the highlights and, well, you made 49 not out.
It's a great-looking shot from Australia's captain.
Punished. Meg Lanning starts into freer arms. South Africa walked onto the field full of smiles. They're playing in a semi-final.
And I think they'll be reasonably happy with that as well as they walk off.
13 overs for South Africa to score 98 as a winning score.
You never look like winning that game. And I cast my mind back to winning. That was a captain's innings. Mm. But the fairy tale potential ending nearly didn't even get the opportunity.
No, it was that's one of the days where it's like I still can't believe it played out how it did. Like, and it gets forgotten a little bit because of the final. But there's no way we should have played on that night. Like, and it was just pure luck or something else. Because
so if you hadn't played, you're done.
Yeah, because we finished second in our pool.
You lost. You lost a game.
Yeah, we lost to India first off.
Gone. That's the last nail in the coffin for Australia. What a comeback it has been for the Indian team.
The wheels came off a bit, to be fair, early in the tournament. We nearly lost to Sri Lanka the next game.
Plenty of cheers from the Australian support. Australia have done it after a tense first six overs.
We were 3 for 10, chasing 120 or 130 in Perth. So
how'd the team react to that? Because this was always, this team doesn't get beaten, they're going to play the final on International Women's Day, it's going to be MCG, they're going to hold up the cup. Now, that happened, but how was the team reacting when this wasn't happening? Because the team was so used to success, and then Pez is out injured. Mm,
Because we'd pretty much won everything coming into that T20 World Cup. And all the talk was about the final.
Yes.
And we'd spoken about it as a group, like, we were like, everyone's just talking about the finals, like, but we sort of need to get there. And we knew it's hard to get to the final of the World Cup. Like, no matter how good you are, like, it's so cutthroat, especially T20, because it's so fickle, because you just have one person have a good couple overs and the game's blown wide open.
Yes.
So everybody just assumed that we were going to be in the final, and it was all they were talking about. And we knew as a team that wasn't just something that was going to happen. But you still sort of try and convince yourself or talk yourself into the fact that it's all right. Like, it'll be okay. Like, it'll happen.
And then you get to the final. So at this stage, you haven't played in front of the crowds of the WPL. What was your thoughts when you walked out there and there was near on 80,000 people there, and the MCG was just humming? It was International Women's Day. It was set up the way that the country hoped it was going to be set up.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't have worked out any better to be playing India as well, who've got an incredible following no matter where they go. They'd obviously beaten us in the first game of the tournament. So in terms of, setting it up for the best possible event and day, it worked out really well. I must admit, early doors when they wanted to play it at the MCG and sell out or get close to, I was a big skeptic. I couldn't see it happening. But, as soon as we were on the bus on the way in, you could just see the crowds, you could hear it. Once we were underneath, you could hear it. And then walking out for the anthems and that on that day was pretty incredible. I remember we were fielding. We were lucky that we got to enjoy our fielding innings, which very rarely happens, especially in T20 cricket. Like, you're on edge for the whole game.
Well, due to the partnership at the start, wasn't it?
You know,
Helium,
nobody
Mini,
else needed
everywhere
to do anything. Yeah,
no.
Yeah, those two were just sort of finished the game off right from the start.
Healy's away, Australia are away. First ball, first boundary of the contest.
Watch it sail over. What a start this is. What a start this is for Australia and for Eliza Healy. Will go for four. Might well be a game-changing 50 this for Eliza Healy.
Yeah, we were fielding and at one stage I think everybody had their phone lights out and they were doing sort of the wave, and I remember looking at Rach Haynes and we just had a big smile on our face, like we could actually take it all in. So that was a special moment to be able to do that, because you don't often get to do that in big games.
And how do you end up on stage with Katy Perry? I went full Bunnings Lab yesterday and I tried to see who was dancing and who wasn't. Admittedly, you were hanging back. But then when the chorus of Firework came, you did start to move your way down the stage and get a lot more involved than I expected you would have been.
Yeah,
but how did you actually end up on the stage?
The dancing and singing is not my thing.
Right.
I think,
had a crack.
Yeah, I did. I probably had a few drinks before. There's no way I was getting out
there.
But
is it an invite from Katie? Does Cricket Australia say,
well,
get on stage?
Well, before the game, there was a bit of like, oh, if we win, we're definitely getting up. And,
okay.
And I think there was a little bit of work done behind the scenes without us knowing to hopefully make that happen if we were to win. We probably would have gone up anyway, to be fair, even if we were allowed to or not allowed to. But we found our way up backstage. Molly Striner and Soph Molyneux were best on grounds.
They were the ones that were right down there.
Oh, doing the worm, doing all sorts of stuff.
They were very good.
But that's their scene. Like that's them. Like they know how to, you know, move the stage, and they enjoy that sort of thing. So I think for the most part I was happy to watch them do all the work. But I don't know. There's actually this one photo of me hugging Katy Perry.
Yes.
She tried to go around me, but I like literally like I grabbed her to make sure it happened. And there's this photo of me and I've got the biggest smile on my face. I do cop it a little bit because a few of my teammates think I was happier then than I was when we actually won the thing. But that is one of my favourite photos actually.
That's the end of Meg Lanning part A. See you for part B.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.